Hello and welcome to the History of Japan podcast, episode 455, In the Shelter of the Pine. Last week we told the story of a tale that had been forgotten and rediscovered, coming to prominence only recently. This week is about a story with, in a certain sense, the precise opposite trajectory. Once upon a time, it was considered to be the foremost piece of contemporary literature written by a woman in Japan, only to fall into comparative obscurity. Only recently has it returned to the spotlight. But in its day, the Matsukage Nikki was a true literary juggernaut. One of the many interesting things about this particular text is its author. Like many of her contemporaries, we do not know that much about her life. But what we do know about her and what of her personality shines through her writing is fascinating. Matsukage Nikki was written by Ogimachi Machiko, the descendant of an ancient and aristocratic family of Kuge, the old aristocracy of Japan. These were families who had risen to prominence almost 1,000 years earlier by attaching themselves to the imperial family before the rise of Japan's warrior class. The Ogimachi in particular were an offshoot of the northern Fujiwara clan, another very prominent family of Kuge aristocrats who had, during the 900s and 1000s CE, dominated Japan's political landscape. However, like all of Kyoto's aristocrats and its imperial family, the Ogimachi had fallen on hard times over the subsequent centuries. The rise of Japan's warrior clans, the samurai in other words, began to politically marginalize the Kyoto aristocracy. That particular trend culminated in the 1400s and 1500s, when the samurai clans divided the country into civil war, while the Kyoto aristocracy were forced onto the sidelines, watching their city burn in conflicts as the warrior clans seized old aristocratic estates to fund their battles. Things had gotten better, to be sure. One of those clans, led by the wily Tokugawa Ieyasu, eventually defeated the others and claimed the position of shogun, leader of Japan's warriors, bringing peace back to the country by the early 1600s. The position of shogun was technically granted by Kyoto's emperor, and to mollify the imperial family and its aristocrats, Ieyasu had granted them new estates to finance their aristocratic lifestyles. But these were not anywhere close to the power the imperial court or the city of Kyoto once enjoyed. Ieyasu granted the imperial family itself a stipend of about 1,000 koku, or bushels of rice, per year, this being a major measure of value in a primarily agrarian economy. He granted himself, meanwhile, lands totaling over 3 million koku. The Ogimachi clan of aristocrats, meanwhile, were given 300 koku a year to sustain themselves. That's a salary roughly equivalent to a mid to upper level retainer of one of Japan's many daimyo, or regional lords from a warrior family. Simply put, the Kyoto aristocracy and the imperial court, including the Ogimachi, were certainly, by the time of the rule of the Tokugawa shoguns, in a better place than they had been during the old civil wars. But they were also distinctly a subordinate class, now living clearly in a system dominated politically by the samurai. As for Ogimachi Machiko, well, again, there's a lot we don't know about her. We're not even technically sure of the year of her birth, which she never states directly in her writing. We have to infer her birth date from the records of her family and from her own oblique references to the events of her life. To put it simply, she was born somewhere between 1677 and 1679. We're also not quite sure who her father was among the Ogimachi, which might seem odd, but in aristocratic families that practiced polygyny, men having relations with multiple women, family trees could get very full and very complicated. The scholarly consensus right now is that Machiko's father was Ogimachi Kinmichi, born in 1653. But you sometimes see it written that Kinmichi's father, Ogimachi Sanetoyo, was her father. This all becomes way more confusing in the actual text of her writing, where Machiko refers to, if we follow the scholarly consensus, her grandfather as her father. However, that's likely because, for reasons we're going to get into in a second, it was Ogimachi Sanetoyo who took on raising young Machiko, serving in the role of her father, even if he was in fact biologically her grandfather. On her mother's side, well, we actually don't even know the name of Machiko's mother, which is not that unusual for women marrying into noble houses. Family genealogies from this time tend to just say the daughter of such and such man married our son so and so. We know that Machiko's mother was referred to by the title Tokiwai, and was the daughter of the Minase, another of Kyoto's aristocratic families, though a substantially more minor one. The Minase in particular were famed for their calligraphy. More than a few aristocratic families relied on cultural trades like poetry, calligraphy, or the other arts, which had a lot of cultural cachet, to boost their own status. A family known for those pursuits could of course bolster their status by securing relations with higher-ranking aristocratic clans, but skills like that were also valuable sources of side income. Aristocratic families did rather well for themselves, selling their traditional skills to samurai families looking to climb socially and boost their own prestige. The Minase were apparently rather good at this kind of social climbing because Machiko's mother Tokiwai came, by unknown means, to the attention of Takatsukasa Fusako, consort of Japan's 112th emperor, Reigen. Reigen ruled, though that seems like not the right verb for a position with ceremonial but not actual authority, from 1663 to 1687. However, even once he abdicated the throne at the age of 33 by modern counting, he remained a powerful force in the Kyoto court. As a jōkō, or retired emperor, Reigen was freed of the complicated and burdensome ceremonies of court and had more time to devote to artistic pursuits, especially poetry, which he loved greatly. Reigen became a massive cultural figure in Kyoto, and that made him in turn highly influential over the court itself. So obviously, a good guy to be connected to. And Takatsukasa Fusako was no slouch herself. The Takatsukasa were at the pinnacle of the Kyoto aristocracy, alongside the Konoe, Kujo, Nijo, and Ichijo families. They were the highest-ranked clans in the city, just below the imperial family. Fusako herself obviously did rather well, ending up with Reigen. Her sister Nobuko was also highly placed. She was married to the brother of the shogun, Tokugawa Ietsuna. And when Ietsuna died unexpectedly in 1680, that brother, Tokugawa Tsunayoshi, found himself elevated to the title of shogun, and Takatsukasa Nobuko was suddenly the shogun's wife. Obviously, this was a big step up in terms of prestige, but for us, what matters is that it also meant Nobuko needed a substantially larger entourage of ladies-in-waiting. Hopefully that was for the form of it all. The shogun's wife needed to be attended by a large number of aristocratic women, but also it was because, as the shogun's wife, she was now responsible for managing his oku, the inner chambers, another word for his harem. That was a pretty important gig, obviously, and so Nobuko reached out to her sister Fusako, who was used to managing the household of someone important, and thus could offer good recommendations. Fusako recommended her lady-in-waiting, Tokiwai, for the job of administrative head of the oku, which was one hell of an opportunity, not least of all because the stipend for a lady-in-waiting in the shogun's family was a lot better than anything on offer in Kyoto, 1,000 koku a year in salary, which was well beyond what most men in Kyoto could aspire to, let alone women. There was one big issue, however. Ladies-in-waiting in the oku were expected to be single, so they could devote their attention fully to the shogun's household. Tokiwai, however, was by this point already married into the Ogimachi family and had given birth to a young daughter, the future Machiko, somewhere between 1 and 3 years earlier. The marriage, honestly, was not a huge issue. Marriages among the Heian aristocracy had always been fairly loose compared to, say, Europe's aristocracy at that time, and fairly easy to dissolve. The kid, on the other hand, was a bit more of a problem. They don't tend to dissolve as easily. Fortunately, there was an easy enough remedy. Ogimachi Sanetoyo, the child's grandfather, was by this point up in years and less involved at court and could take over the girl's education and take on a role as her father, a convenient fiction probably intended to protect the lie that Tokiwai was not married and had no kids. He was, by Machiko's own later account, a deeply doting parental figure, as she recalls in her writing, quote, "As a child, I was always by his side, sometimes grinding his ink, sometimes trying out his writing brushes, so that when he wanted to write something and I happened to be elsewhere, he would say, 'Where's my little girl? Have her come here.' So devoted were we to one another that I spent almost every day by his side." Life in Kyoto with her grandfather was clearly pleasant, but Machiko too ended up leaving it, thanks to her mother, who did not forget her daughter, and, once Machiko was a bit older, wrote her constantly, offering her a place at the shogun's court. Machiko, by her own later recollections, was initially hesitant, but her family, either out of a desire to see her rise in life, or interest in those sweet shogunal stipends, pressured her to accept. And so, sometime around 1693, Machiko went east, as she put it, making her way to the shogun's capital city of Edo, at this point the largest city in Japan. Specifically, Tokiwai arranged a position for her daughter as a concubine of one of the rising stars of the shogun's court, Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu, the soba yonin of the shogun Tsunayoshi. Simply put, Yanagisawa's job was to be an advisor and adjutant to the shogun, responsible for being his go-between with the roju, the shogun's advisors who ran things day to day. Think of it like the Hand of the King in Game of Thrones, if that helps. Yanagisawa had known Tokugawa Tsunayoshi for most of his life. He was 12 years younger than Tsunayoshi was deeply loyal and devoted to him. Obviously, he was quite influential thanks to this connection. Possibly more important for Ogimachi Machiko, he was also extremely wealthy because of it. When Machiko became his concubine, Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu had an annual stipend from his various positions and his feudal holdings of over 70,000 koku. Over the course of their time together, that number would increase to 200,000 koku a year, a level of wealth putting him on par with several of Japan's most wealthy daimyo, and well beyond what anyone could offer in Kyoto. One imagines this was a not insubstantial attraction for Machiko, but what about Yoshiyasu? Why was he interested in bringing Machiko into his household? It was not for a male heir, the most pressing need of any warrior house, since houses could be disinherited if they lacked one. Yoshiyasu had married at 16 to a daughter of another warrior house named Soshisada. However, the two never had any children for unclear reasons, though they did adopt four girls together from other warrior families. Instead, Yoshiyasu took a concubine from his mother's ladies-in-waiting by the name of Iizuka Some. Together they would have five children, and while tragically four would die in infancy, one would survive to become Yoshiyasu's heir, Yoshisato. Machiko did provide Yoshiyasu with two more sons, Tokichika and Yasumichi, but after Yasumichi was born in late 1694, the two never had another child together, and that was not apparently for a lack of interest in the subject on Yoshiyasu's part, because altogether he fathered 16 biological children by six different women. Clearly, Machiko provided him with something else, something very important to him, a connection to Kyoto's imperial court. Interestingly, their relationship had to be predicated on a fiction that Machiko was not, in fact, a part of the Kyoto aristocracy. No matter how impoverished they were, no aristocratic house like the Ogimachi could stoop to provide concubines for a vassal house of mere samurai like the Yanagisawa. So Machiko first had to be adopted into another samurai family before Yoshiyasu could take her into his household to preserve the fiction that he was not acting above his station. But even though she was not supposed to be an aristocrat, obviously Machiko still was. Her access to the court was enormously important for someone like Yoshiyasu, who served in the government of the Tokugawa shoguns, but worked not for the institution, but for the shogun Tsunayoshi himself. What do I mean by that? Well, say, for example, that Tsunayoshi wished to honor his mother, the Lady Keishoin, with a high rank in the imperial court hierarchy, specifically a title of the first rank, normally the sort of thing that was handed out posthumously and thus by definition, not something one is normally around to enjoy. Yanagisawa would be the man he would go to make this happen. And to achieve what his master wanted, Yanagisawa would turn to his concubine, Ogimachi Machiko. In point of fact, this is something that actually happened. Tsuneyoshi did ask for that, and Yanagisawa arranged it, reaching out to the retired Emperor Reigen to do so. This was a huge deal, and probably Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu's single biggest political accomplishment. Even the shogun Tokugawa Tsuneyoshi himself did not receive a title of the first rank until more than a month after his death. It's not stated directly in any of Machiko's writings, which we will get to in a second, but from context, it's pretty likely that Machiko and her family served as intermediaries at court making this happen. Machiko's connections were also useful for Yoshiyasu on a purely personal level, particularly because he was enormously fond of waka poetry. For a quick refresh, waka is the traditional court poetry of classical Japan, the poetry of Kino Tsurayuki and Fujiwara no Teika and the classic authors of the past. Yoshiyasu loved this stuff. He was not interested in newfangled haiku, like the kind being composed by this old weirdo named Matsuo Basho who was doing the rounds at this time in Edo. He was a man of the classics, and in the context of poetry, and pretty much every other art, that meant the classics of the court. Machiko and her family were able to arrange all sorts of poetic delights for Yoshiyasu. Probably most exciting for him, they arranged for the retired Emperor Reigen himself to read a few of Yoshiyasu's waka poems and provide commentary on them, sort of the equivalent of your friend the aspiring musician managing to get a few minutes of critique from someone whose albums have gone platinum? That's the thing, right? I think it is. Anyway, the Ogimachis used their connections at court to arrange for both Yoshiyasu and his son and heir Yoshisato to receive training in waka poetry from a family of distinguished aristocratic poets, the Nakanoin family, who ever since the days of the scholar Nakanoin Michikatsu and his fascinating daughter Nakako in the late 1500s, had been among the foremost scholars of the court's arts and literature. And when in 1702 Yoshiyasu's copies of the classic imperial poetry anthologies of the Heian era were lost in a fire, the Ogimachi connection led to the retired Emperor Reigen ordering no less than 62 different Kyoto aristocrats to work together on creating new copies of the three most important texts in that collection, the Kokin Wakashu, the Gosen Wakashu, and the Shui Wakashu, if you're wondering. This was important both because, of course, of who was giving the gift, a retired emperor, and because of how important referencing those classic texts is to the composition of waka. You literally can't write the poems without some way of referencing the classics. Now, I should note two things here. First, Yoshiyasu asked a lot of the Ogimachi family, but he gave back plenty as well. Using his pull in Edo, Yoshiyasu was able to pay the family back substantially, for example, by nominating Machiko's probable father, Ogimachi Kinmichi, to the position of Buke Densoyaku, essentially the member of the court responsible for managing relations with the samurai class. Yoshiyasu could also pay back these favors by arranging marriages with respectable warrior families. It was certainly not just the Ogimachi who were strapped for cash and looking desirously at all those sweet warrior family stipends. For example, for Nonomiya Ikuko, one of the daughters of an aristocratic poetry teacher of his, to whom he was introduced by the Ogimachis, Yoshiyasu was able to arrange a marriage to Okubo Tadamasu, heir to the 40,000 koku Odawara domain. Yoshiyasu also arranged for Machiko's younger sister, Ikiko, to marry Matsudaira Tomoaki, a second son of the Owari branch of the Tokugawa family, who was later made into a full daimyo with his own domain. And of course, beyond favors like this, Yoshiyasu could, and certainly did, pay for all of this aristocratic generosity with cold, hard cash. The other thing I should mention is, well, actually the thing this episode is supposedly about. Because the convenience of this arrangement for both aristocrat and samurai is, of course, fascinating, but I did start us off by saying we were going to be talking about literature, didn't I? So where is the literature? The answer is right here all along. Indeed, it's one of the main sources we have about Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu and his family, and despite all the various wheeling and dealing we've been talking about, probably for historians, this is the single most important legacy of Machiko and Yoshiyasu's whole relationship. You see, one of the many things Machiko did for the man she was pledged to was write something, a text called the Matsukage Nikki, often translated as In the Shelter of the Pines, after the lovely phrasing of Dr. G.G. Rowley's translation, though a more literal reading would be something like Pine Tree Shadow Diary. Matsukage Nikki is, simply put, a sort of official biography of Yoshiyasu and his public career. The term Nikki, or diary, might seem odd in that context, but remember there's a long-standing convention in Japanese literature of public diaries intended to be consumed by readers, where the diary is more of a convention intended to allow for the expression of emotion on the part of the writer. Indeed, the Matsukage Nikki itself clearly draws inspiration from classics of Japanese literature, like the 11th century classic Eiga Monogatari, a sort of valorization of the grandeurs of the old Fujiwara family of court aristocrats. It also makes regular allusions to other classic bits of literature, from the classic waka poetry collections to the Tale of Genji. To be clear, this was a diary, but it was not an attempt to do some sort of literary realism in the sense we'd recognize it. Yoshiyasu is not portrayed as a flawed, realistic character in any normal sense, but as a paragon of warrior virtue. Indeed, even the name of the text is intended to demonstrate Yoshiyasu's humility. Matsu, or pine in this case, comes from Matsudaira, the original family name of the Tokugawa shoguns, before they switched it to the more regal-sounding Tokugawa. Kage, or shadow, implies being overshadowed. Thus, Matsukage together refers to Yoshiyasu dwelling happily in the shadow of the pine, in this case his master Tokugawa Tsuneyoshi. And by the way, Tsuneyoshi's favor for Yoshiyasu was such that he eventually granted Yoshiyasu both the right to use the family name Matsudaira himself, as well as control over the domain of Kofu in Mountainous Kai Province, now Yamanashi Prefecture. That last move was particularly controversial because Kofu domain had traditionally belonged to the Tokugawa family and been passed down by direct descendants of Ieyasu himself. Handing the territory over to Yanagisawa, who was not from the family, was thus both a singular honor and massively controversial. So you can see why Yoshiyasu might want to play up this public image of extreme loyalty, given the regular insinuation that he was in some way taking advantage of the shogun. Anyway, Matsukage Nikki was also not intended to be some sort of family history passed down among the Yanagisawa. There was actually an entirely separate private family history compiled by Confucian scholars at Yoshiyasu's request, called the Rakushido Nenroku, very roughly, Annals of the Hall of Rejoicing in Virtue. That text was not even shown to anyone outside of the Yanagisawa family until 1870. It was not public by any stretch of the imagination. The Matsukage Nikki, on the other hand, was very clearly intended to be read by people outside the family. Hence all the fancy literary allusions and such scattered throughout the text, and the extreme care taken to burnish Yoshiyasu's public image. In case it's not clear, Matsukage Nikki is not a text about its author. Ogimachi Machiko appears only indirectly in the story, for example, when the births of her children are described. Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu is by any reasonable measure the protagonist of the narrative. This is a story about him. That said, it's not like Machiko's invisible. Indeed, one of the most interesting linguistic features of the text is that it has her fingerprints all over it. You see, Ogimachi Machiko may have spent most of her life as a part of a samurai household, but her attitude was Kyoto aristocrat to the core. One of the ways she conveyed that was through the language she chose in Matsukage Nikki, all of which was deliberately chosen to be evocative of the old classics of pre-war government. In her phrasing of goings-on at the heart of warrior government, she steadfastly avoided any phrases or words that may have acknowledged that anything had changed since the golden age of the Kyoto Imperial Court. What does that mean? Well, for one thing, she assiduously avoided even saying the very name of the city she resided in. Edo, as a term, does not appear even once in the whole text. It is always indirectly referred to with terms like the East. East, of course, relative to Kyoto. Similarly, the terminology of bakufu titles was carefully avoided. Nobody was referred to as a daimyo, or a roju, or a wakadoshiyori, the junior or senior counselors responsible for helping the shogun run the government. Even Yoshiyasu is never referred to as a yonin, or adjutant. Instead, everyone is referred to by courtly titles they'd received as honorifics from the emperor, as chamberlains, honorary officers of the emperor's palace guards, one of Kyoto's various city commissioners. None of those titles had any real responsibility, but they were ancient and had a lot of symbolism attached to them, and they were positions that had appeared frequently in the literary classics Machiko was so fond of alluding to. My personal favorite, where the terms of warrior government were unavoidable, she would go to great lengths to come up with some more classical-sounding synonym. For example, in some cases it was unavoidable to refer to one or another person as a daimyo, one of Japan's provincial lords. But Machiko still would not use that term, preferring the far wordier kuni no aruji, or ruler of a province. Similarly, where the offices of the roju or wakadoshiyori were referenced, they were the shisegonin and shitsujionin, roughly five men responsible for executing the shogun's orders, and their four assistants. That didn't just apply to titles, by the way, though it's more noticeable in that context. For example, Machiko never uses the word chirimen, or silk crepe, preferring the more old-timey sounding kara no kinu, or Chinese silks. The effect is a very odd one. It's very recognizable reading Matsukage Nikki that Machiko is talking about life in a warrior household, and yet the effect of all the language is to make it feel like little has changed since the height of the court 1,000 years earlier. If you're wondering what the text actually looks like, it's an annual record of events that literally begins with the founding of the Tokugawa shogunate. And I do just have to mention here how she describes the founding of the shogunate. This is how she describes Tokugawa Ieyasu's brutal rise to power during the late civil wars of the 1500s. At the time, the lowly rose up victorious while their superiors fell to ruin, the several provinces were rent asunder, each fragment of which went its own way, waging war against the other, until this world knew not a day of peace. Whereupon our august divine avatar, whose very name one hesitates to speak, aroused himself in a spirit of fearless daring. Like a tiger he raged, like a dragon he soared, destroying this one, subduing that one, offering obeisance to the emperor and stability to the people, so that before very long every last lord in the land had yielded to him, and for 100 and more years the waves on the four seas have been calm, while the 100 rivers now flow replete with water, and the laws of the land have been made uniform. The realm is defended from reign to reign, the noble houses pass down their age-old traditions, and the four classes of people have all attained their appointed place. Naturally, of course, most of the narrative is focused on Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu, whom Machiko refers to as my lord, and most of the detail picks up after Machiko arrives in his household. Particularly lavishly described is the first of many visits by Tokugawa Tsuneyoshi as shogun to Yoshiyasu's home. The visits are frequent, but the details of the first one are expounded on in great detail so as to help the reader picture events. This visit, if you are wondering, was an all-day affair that took months to prepare, literally. Tsuneyoshi indicated an interest in the visit shortly after the Lunar New Year of 1691, at which point Yoshiyasu devoted himself from the first day of the second lunar month to the 22nd day of the third lunar month to building a massive pavilion within his mansion for the whole get-together, including things like a dining hall and a no stage, as well as an area for Tsuneyoshi's entourage to relax while they waited. This all might seem a bit excessive, but the scope of the project was absolutely necessary because a visit by the shogun was an all-day affair. It began in the mid-morning, the hour of the serpent, so 9 to 11 a.m., and the visit included a fair amount of eating, a mid-morning snack, lunch, and dinner, several very lavish gift-giving ceremonies, a no performance, which apparently some members of the entourage joined, and even a lecture delivered by Tsuneyoshi himself alongside Yoshiyasu. Both were scholarly men with a deep interest in Confucianism. Apparently the topic that time was the Xiaojing, or classic of filial piety. The entertainments continued until dusk, when Tsuneyoshi finally went home. If you're wondering about the gifts, they're quite something. Yoshiyasu, as the inferior in the relationship, was supposed to be the less generous of the two. He merely gave his lord some sake and silver, as well as a nice horse with bespoke tack. Tsuneyoshi, in turn, gave the more generous gifts to establish his benevolence and superior social status, which included several late medieval swords, the best of which was forged by Rai Kunitoshi, one of Japan's most famous swordsmiths. There was also some high-end Chinese silk, a silver censer for incense, a bunch of gold and silver boxes, some painted folding screens. To cap it off, a Ming Dynasty copy of the classic of filial piety, written in the calligraphy of a famous master from China's Ming Dynasty, and a bunch of poems written by and in the hands of the great poets of the Fujiwara family from the 1000s and 1100s CE. And this was the first of what I really want to stress were no less than 58 formal visits over the course of Tsuneyoshi's reign. So what else does the text describe? Well, quite a bit. For example, chapter 4 describes Yoshiyasu's religious proclivities, including an awakening interest in Buddhism that culminates in a meeting with two of Japan's great Zen masters in the late 1600s, Jikudo, an abbot of the Rinzai Zen Temple at Ryukoji, and Gaochuen Shingdun / Kosen Shoton of the Obaku sect, whose temple was at Manpukuji in Kyoto. Which reminds me that I really need to do an episode on Obaku Zen at some point because it's very interesting. Another section talks about the marriage of one of the couple's many adopted daughters, Etsuko, the niece of Yoshiyasu's primary wife, to the daimyo Naito Masamori, and the number of prestigious lords who attended her send-off. And every single one of these descriptions is peppered with references and allusions to the classics of Japanese literature. For example, in the summer of 1698, Yoshiyasu took ill. This is how that moment is described in the text. My lord was responsible for a great many people, and the press of his duties was unrelenting. There was not a moment's respite. Perhaps because it was that season that makes the earth break itself open, he found it unbearable and began to feel so unwell that he shut himself away at home. The Earth Itself Breaks Open is a reference to the Manyoshu, poem 1999, it's also Shuiwakushu 825. Minasuki no tsuchi sae sakete teru hini mo waga sode hime ya kimi ni awazute. In the sixth month, the earth breaks open in the blazing sun, but it does not dry my sleeves, for I never meet my lord. The text ends in the middle of 1709 with an exchange of poems between Yoshiyasu and two of his aristocratic teachers, Nakanoin Michimi and Nonomiya Sadamoto. Yoshiyasu's own death in 1714 is not described, neither is Ogimachi Machiko's on the 11th day of the third lunar month of 1724. For much of the rest of the Edo period, Matsukage Nikki was widely circulated as a copied manuscript, recopied by hand for decades before it was printed for the first time in 1881. It was, by pretty much any measure, the most popular piece of literature written by a woman during the Edo period. And it's kind of easy to see why. The courtly literary writing style Machiko employed was obviously intended to parallel texts like The Tale of Genji, tying Machiko to another piece that was by this point already recognized as one of the greatest classics of Japanese literature ever produced. The effect clearly clicked with a lot of readers, and it meant a great deal to Machiko as well. To quote Dr. G.G. Rowley, by describing life at the Yanagisawa Mansion and the Rikugien, the family garden which is still around, it was preserved by the Iwasaki family of Mitsubishi, as if they were Genji's fictional Rokujo estate, Machiko depicts herself as one of the Shining Genji's own ladies. And though Machiko lived among members of the military estate for all of her adult life, so far as we can tell from In the Shelter of the Pine, her fidelity to the aristocracy to which she was born never faltered. This, to me, is the most interesting thing about Matsukage Nikki. Again, and I cannot stress this enough, in terms of the narrative proper, Machiko is barely a character, particularly relative to the powerful men around her. And yet the way she wrote the text is so distinctive, you can tell so much about her without her needing to say a thing. On every single page, you can still feel her presence. That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. This show is part of the Facing Backward podcast network. You can find out more about this show and our other shows at facingbackward.com or our social media, facebook.com/facingbackwardpodcasts or at Backward History on Twitter. You can support the network at patreon.com/facingbackward. Special thanks to those who have given at our shout-out tier: Jan Leonard, Stephen Elkins, Martin Oliveira, Clark Canning, Ian Kellett, Matt Haynes, Jackie Frostocker, Monkey Sack, Alayla McCulloch, Karen Murphy, Peter Wales, Robert Prin, William, Arno, Jonas Brandis, Nicholas Kroll, Jerry Spinrad, Jared Stevens, Jeffrey Dwork, Stefan Hruschka, Joshua Kane, A House is a Perfectly Cromulent Mascot, and The Fish I Catch Are Rhodes Scholars Compared to Samuel Alito, Schmuck. You can also find out more about this show in particular at facebook.com/historyofjapanpodcast. Thanks to those who have given to the podcast Patreon, Dylan, and Nova for donating to support the show. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week when we tackle a very old but thoroughly modern story of Tsuneno, the peasant-turned-big-city woman.